Property crime is very common in our society, and we all take steps to prevent it, don't we? I have keys in my pocket that go to the house and the car, and we have all kinds of things that we do to try to protect ourselves from somebody stealing things from us. In fact, according to the U.S. Department of Justice statistics, there is quite a bit of property crime in our country. I think the last year that they had statistics for, the last year that I could find statistics for from them was 2009. And 15.6 million property crimes. That's a lot of crime. Being the accountant, I had to crunch some numbers and figure out how many that was per minute, how many minutes that is per, 29.7 per minute every 2 seconds. There is some kind of property crime that's going on in our country. And, of course, that doesn't count the rest of the world. An additional fact that I found interesting on the Department of Justice website is only about 40% of property crimes are ever reported. So there's probably a whole lot more than what they report going on, which means more than one every 2 seconds. If it's less than half or reported, that's every second. There's some kind of property crime going on somewhere in the United States. It's a lot of disrespect of other people's property. Now, not surprisingly, God has something to say about that topic of respecting the property of others in the Bible. One of the passages of yesterday's Read the Bible in the Year reading, suggested reading segments was in the book of Ezekiel. It was Ezekiel 38. And it describes a time when Gog and Magog, during the time of the millennium, in fact, let's turn there. I'd like to read a little bit of that. Something that's going to come into their mind when they see how much prosperity there is and the peace that is there, they're going to get a bright idea. At least they're going to think it's a bright idea. And God points out that it's not such a bright idea. He looks on it pretty dimly. So here we are in Ezekiel chapter 38. Let's pick it up in verse 8. It says, "After many days you will be visited. In the latter days you will come to the land of those brought back from the sword and gathered from many people on the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They were brought out of their nations, and now all of them dwell safely. And of course, he's referring to Israel, that God will bring Israel back. There will be a second exodus, and in the millennium, God is going to bring Israel back to their land. They'll dwell safely there. And verse 9, and you can back up a few verses and see that this is speaking to Gog as the chapter begins. It says, "You will ascend, coming like a storm, covering the land like a cloud, you and all your troops and many peoples with you. Thus says the Lord God, on that day it'll come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan. You will say, 'I'll go up against a land of unwalled villages. I will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take plunder, to take booty, to stretch out your hand against the waste places that are again inhabited and against a people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and goods who dwell in the midst of the land.'" So now remember, this is during a time that's described as not having war, when swords are beat into plowshares, and people don't learn war anymore. Nation doesn't go up against nation in warfare. And this passage says they're going to come up. Gog is going to come up against Israel, who's brought back out of captivity. They don't have any walls around their cities. They don't have any bars. They don't have any gates. Am I talking too loud? Looks like it's... Move this back a little. Maybe that's be a little bit better. They don't have any walls. They don't have any bars, no gates. That's a waste of money during this time because there's going to be such peace. And he says, "Gog, you're gonna decide. I'm just gonna go take it." I mean, they got all kinds of goods there. They got all kinds of prosperity and all kinds of booty. I'm gonna go up and take it. And God says he'll destroy Gog because of that. All but a sixth of them. He'll leave a small portion of them. You can read the rest of the passage, but he says he'll rain down fire and brimstone, hailstones, brimstone on them. He's not going to let them do what this evil plan that they have hatched would want them to do. And in fact, it says Israel is going to burn the implements of their warfare for 7 years. They won't even have to cut anything out of the forest for firewood. This is, of course, describing during in a picture that would be or make sense during that day. In other words, the stuff that they leave behind them because of dying, you're going to live off of that for 6-7 years. That's a tremendous amount of booty that those who were going to take booty are going to end up giving it. Now, that's an interesting concept, isn't it? Instead of taking, you give. It's going to come back into play when we finish what we're talking about today. Obviously, I'm going to talk about the Eighth Commandment. The commandment is very simple. When you look at it, God simply says in Exodus 20 and verse 15, you shall not steal. You shall not steal. You shall not take. What is stealing? Well, it's taking what belongs to somebody else, something that is not yours. Not a hard concept to understand. In fact, in the Hebrew, I'll put the Hebrew up here. Do I attempt to pronounce it? Lo gonab, I believe, is somewhat close to what the lexicons say that's supposed to be pronounced as. But it's real simple. It literally just means not to steal. And, of course, it's in the imperative sense, so it means you don't do this. You shall not steal. You shall not take what belongs to other people. It's real simple. This is one of those trees in the forest of God's commands to us. And it's a very simple one. The trunk is pretty straight. No twists and turns in this. It's pretty easy to understand. No great surprises in this. No misdirections. Very plain and simple. Don't take what isn't yours. Don't take what you don't own. If somebody else owns it, it's theirs. It's not yours. Now, when it comes to the commandments, I've typically taken the time to at least go to one or two places where we find this command in effect, that it is something that is important, something that God is concerned about before we come to Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 20, where God wrote down in written form his Ten Commandments, the basic moral law that God had recorded at that time. Who can think of a time prior to Mount Sinai? In fact, what's the first example of not respecting the property or the property rights of others that you can think of? Anybody want to share something? What can you think of as one of the first examples of not respecting the property or the rights of others in the Bible? All right, back in the back. Adam and Eve ate of the tree. In fact, God had given them specific instruction about all of the garden, didn't he? We can turn to Genesis chapter 2 and look at that. Genesis chapter 2 and verses 15, 16, and 17 really is all we need to look at. It says, the Lord God took the man, put him in the garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat. It's yours. Enjoy it. Do what you like with that. Enjoy all of that fruit. But, he said, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you'll surely die. God said, here's one tree. This tree I'm claiming is mine. I don't want you to eat of it. This is my tree. He didn't tell them they couldn't look at it, but he just said, don't eat of it. This is my tree. You got all the rest of the garden. That's yours. And, of course, guess who came along and convinced them they needed that one tree that God said set aside as his. And so Adam and Eve ate of that tree, and we know the rest of the story from there. So you might think of one that might be even before the Garden of Eden. Okay? Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Isn't that a bit of a property right issue? When we go to Isaiah 14, it talks about Lucifer saying, I will sit on the throne. In essence, he's saying, I will take God's throne, not just be like the Most High, but I will be the Most High. I'll sit on the mount. Let's turn and read that so I don't misquote it. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you're cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I'll also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. And what's the Most High like? Well, he sits on his throne. He's above everything else. And what Lucifer is describing here is, I want to displace God. I want to take what he has. I want to take that position of being at the top in the sides of the north. You know, we've typically said, well, this is an indication of that may be, if there's any directionality in terms of where God's throne is, that could be where it is. Symbolically, though, Lucifer is looking to take God's throne. He's looking to take from God. So we have a couple of passages here before Mount Sinai. I'd like to turn to one other one. This one is perhaps, you might say, well, that one's a little bit, it's not a specific taking of a literal crown, but that's what Lucifer was wanting to do. Symbolically, he was wanting to take something that God had reserved. And in Genesis 2, we certainly see God had reserved one tree for himself. Let's go to Genesis chapter 21. I'd like to also look at, in the physical sense, the stealing of property from someone else. This had to do with real property. Genesis chapter 21. We find Abraham is sitting down and talking with Abimelech. In fact, verse 22, it came to pass that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, came to Abraham. So they were sitting down and having a discussion. And Abraham brings up a complaint that he has against Abimelech. And he says to him in verse 25, Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of the well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You didn't tell me, nor have I heard of it until today. It's news to me. Somebody stole your well? What are my guys doing? No, nobody's told me that happened, Abraham. In verse 27, so Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. And Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech asked Abraham, what's the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs? Why'd you pull them out and put them separately? And Abraham's response was, you will take these 7 ewe lambs from my hand that they may be witness that I have dug this well. Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because the two of them swore an oath there. So Abimelech's servants had stolen Abraham's well, and Abimelech didn't know it. Now, this sort of ceremony that Abraham is proposing, that Abraham goes through, has struck me as kind of interesting. Why go through all of this? Why not just tell Abimelech, give it back? I want it back. Tell your servants it's mine. Give it to me. Sounds like Abimelech was of a mind to do it. I didn't know that. Nobody told me that. So why was Abraham going through this elaborate system of giving things? In fact, in one sense, why would he give to get back what he already owned? Why would he give him 7 lambs when he already owned the well? I find that rather interesting to note what he did. It seems maybe a little strange that he bought it back, you could say, or paid to get it back. But the point seems to be that Abraham's doing a couple of things. Number one, I believe Abraham is having Abimelech and his commander, the commander of his army, Phicol, the commander of the army, is there. This is a very high-ranking official and somebody who's in the army who has the power to enforce something that's true. And he's having that official, along with Abimelech, give public acknowledgement to the fact that that well belongs to Abraham. That Abraham's servants dug that well, therefore it belongs to him. And it's not Abimelech's servants or somebody else's property to take or to seize control of. And Abraham, in a sense, was erring on the side of generosity. Rather than simply saying, you guys publicly acknowledge this, I want you to acknowledge this is my well. You guys keep your grubby mitts off it, Abraham was wise. He was, because look what it says in verse 34. It says, Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. Now, did Abraham have an idea that he was going to do that? Maybe. I think Abraham understood a little bit about psychology, though. So what it comes across to me as, that if I go softly, if I err on the side of generosity with Abimelech, I can accomplish 2 things. Number one, I can make him admit, yes, this is my well. And secondly, I can make him happy about doing it. Because I've given him a gift. I've sent him away with more than he had when he came. Seems to me kind of a wise way for Abraham to deal when he was going to dwell in their land for quite a while. So We find that even before Mount Sinai, property and respecting the property rights of others is indicated in the Bible as something that God is concerned about. One of the things that's interesting about this command, if you read different things about it and try to analyze it, I think it's interesting to note how God assigns value to things. Now, God does value things, but did you realize there's no death penalty for theft? God nowhere commands the death penalty for the stealing of property. It's not a part of the way God values material, physical things. God doesn't see it as something that is worth taking a human life over. Now, there are other ancient cultures that did put people to death for stealing. But God has a different valuation. He doesn't do that. The normal penalty for stealing property was some kind of fine along with restitution. We'll come to that in just a minute. But there is a death penalty if you steal a person. If you take a human being, God says the death penalty applies. I find that interesting to see how God values things. We'll see that in God's instruction to Israel. But what I conclude from that is, we'll see in a little bit what those points, but what I conclude from that is that God looks at stuff as just stuff. I mean, yes, it's important. God is concerned about property rights, but it doesn't have the value, doesn't rise to the level of importance in God's mind that life does, that human beings do. God is much more interested in people. He's more interested in human beings than he is in material, physical things. I don't want to get sidetracked on this, but I've seen way too many instances where people assign too high a value on material things instead of people. That's really a sad thing to have happen. You know, in God's eyes, human beings, even slaves, the life of the slave was closely guarded. If a master caused even the loss of a tooth for a servant, that servant was supposed to go free. God says, you treat another human being with dignity, you treat them with respect, you treat them kindly. I think it's because God recognizes human beings or potential family members of his. And that's, again, very different from the legal codes of all the other nations of ancient times there in the Middle East. Let's look at some penalties for stealing, some of the things that God told ancient Israel. First of all, we'll look at property. We'll get into stealing a person later. What kind of property can be stolen? Well, our legal system looks at two different types, basically. Real property, which we looked at with Abimelech. Physical, real property in the sense of real estate, we would call it today, or it talks about personal property. And God actually describes both of these as well. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs chapter 23, we'll see that God makes a statement about the importance of real property, real estate, being properly assigned and staying with the rightful owner. Here in Proverbs chapter 23, amidst many other statements of wisdom, of wise action, God makes this statement, verses 10 and 11, "Do not remove the ancient landmark, nor enter the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is mighty. He will plead their cause against you." Don't remove the ancient landmark. Now, again, in ancient times, we didn't have what we do today. Today, we have land plots, and we have plats that are in the county seat or in the county courthouse that are recorded that talk about how surveyors will take a particular point and they'll go this far and it's so many feet on this way and then takes another angle. And we got all this legal write-up of where property is and how you describe how you find that property. In ancient days, all they used were landmarks. They would put stones or a mound of stones or some huge stone or mark a tree, an ancient tree that would be a boundary marker, and those were considered the boundaries. And what God is saying is, you know, human nature is, I would like to get more than is mine. And if I shift that marker a little bit, I can get a little bit more land for grazing or for planting crops. And God says, don't do that. That boundary was set there. It establishes what is your property and what is your neighbor's property. What's the old saying? Good fences make good neighbors. God's saying, that's a fence. That's a mark. Don't move it. Be honest with your neighbor. Don't take their land. Now, when Israel was freed from Egypt, obviously they didn't have any land, did they? They were wandering through the wilderness for about 40 years, and God, as they came close to the promised land, in the book of Deuteronomy, began to give instruction about various things, and he gave instruction about land ownership as well. Let's take a look at that in Deuteronomy chapter 19. We'll find it's the same thing that he says here, but in Deuteronomy chapter 19, as they were drawing close to the promised land, or close to inheriting the promised land, God, through Moses, gave instruction about some cities of refuge and talked about a number of different things. But down in verse 14, we find this instruction about land, about real estate. Verse 14, he says, "You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, when the men of old, which the men of old have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess." So in advance of beginning to own real property, God says, listen, it's important that when you set those boundaries are set up and they mark who owns what property. You respect that and you don't try to move that landmark or that property. Adam Clark's commentary points out that the Romans were very concerned about landmarks. And the penalty in Rome or under the Roman government at times was death for moving a landmark. They were pretty strict. Let's see, they were described as, what is it in the book of Daniel? Iron? they were pretty staunch in what they enforced. And if somebody was caught moving a landmark, there was potential that person could die for that. Well, God doesn't say that, that he'll kill a person, but he does say, don't remove the landmark, don't move it. It's something that's very important. Now, what about personal property, things that we could own individually, that we could carry with us, that we could take with us, perhaps, or things that are not land or houses? Here's where we see there's a general penalty of restitution along with some kind of fine. If we go to Exodus chapter 22... Exodus chapter 22, it's a passage that is pretty well known by many of us. Verse 1 says, "If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep." So God is saying, if you take an animal, an ox or a sheep, some type of an animal, you slaughter it or you sell it, here's what you have to do. You have to restore it, either fourfold or fivefold. Now, people have made an issue of the difference in ox and sheep. Does anybody want to share what's the difference? Why more for an ox than for a sheep? Why fivefold instead of fourfold? Yes, Nancy. Okay, an ox works. An ox is, in one sense, an ox is an implement of livelihood, isn't it? Because an ox can plow, an ox can pull a cart, an ox can carry heavy loads. You don't typically see farmers loading their sheep with heavy burdens, do you? I haven't seen too many saddles for sheep either. We own some sheep and we sheared them, but you get there are some things, there are some productive things that you get from sheep, but typically you don't see them as a means of livelihood in the sense of productivity, like an ox is. An ox is strong. An ox has we might call it the tractor of ancient times. You know, I mean, they were the ones that did that type of heavy work, that a man would have to work a long time to be able to do the same kind of work that an ox can do in a short time. So we believe that that's probably why God delineates here 5 for an ox and 4 for a sheep that a man is to restore. Now, this is not really the beginning of property rights. This is kind of jumping into the middle of it. If you look back into chapter 21, you'll find that there are some other instances of property rights. In fact, I was looking through Expositor's Bible Commentary, and they point out that this is the third of 5 types of property damage that God describes in this general section of Exodus. So let's back up and take a look at the beginning of those. The first one is found in verse 33. In the previous chapter, Exodus chapter 21, verses 33 and 34, these personal property I'll call them principles for alliteration's sake. Personal property principles, PPP. All right, let's Exodus chapter 21 in verse 33. It says, if a man opens a pit, or if a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls in it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money to their owner, but the dead animal shall be his. So this is what you might call damage from negligence. I dig a pit, I dig a hole, or I uncover a pit that has been dug and yet covered over. I uncover it and I leave it. And somebody's animal wanders along and falls into that pit and it kills that animal. Who's responsible for the death of that animal? I am. Because I'm negligent. I caused the death of that animal. I, in essence, stole from my neighbor, whoever's animal that was, because I didn't take precautions to make sure that was safe. I left something that was, I was negligent. And in this sense, we might say culpably negligent, doing something that causes a property loss. Well, the interesting thing in this is God doesn't say restore four or five for one. He just says you pay for the animal. But guess what? By the way, that dead animal's yours now. You get to haul him out of that pit and figure out how you're gonna bury that animal or dispose of that animal. You're the one that caused the problem, so you are the one. It's one-to-one replacement that is made, but you're the one responsible to take care of that dead animal. So that's one type of property damage that God, again, shows we're to be concerned about our neighbor. Love our neighbor as ourselves. We wouldn't want someone else doing something that our animal would be killed because of, just falling into a pit. So you restore that animal, and you take care of the dead animal. Verse 35, we find another kind of property damage that's talked about in verses 35 and 36. If one man's ox hurts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox they shall also divide. In other words, if it's an animal fight, and one animal kills the other animal, God is saying, it's hard to know what an animal's going to do. And you can train animals, you can teach them, and you can do it. Man has done a lot in terms of taming animals, but they're still wild animals. And a wild animal sometimes will do things that are unpredictable. And sometimes they will fight with one another. And if they do, God says there's really no culpability for either of the owners. So let's just even the playing ground or playing field. Half, you sell the live animal. The one whose animal killed the other animal, you don't get to keep your animal, even if you've got sentimental value to it. You sell the animal. You get half of the proceeds. The person whose animal died gets half the proceeds. And guess what? Both of you have to take care of the dead one. You take care of that dead animal equally. So God says, let's just keep it even. But notice verse 36. What if that animal already, you knew that animal, had a history of wanting to fight with other animals? Verse 36 says, or if it was known the ox tended to thrust in time past, and its owner has not kept it confined, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall be his own. Back to the culpable negligence. Same practice, isn't it? Same thing. You restore, you pay for that animal, and the dead animal's yours. You have to take care of disposing it. So God's concerned about animals there and taking care of them. We come back to chapter 22, and we're back to where we started, stealing an animal and killing or selling it. But notice there's a difference in verse 4. If you sell that animal, God says you restore five for or kill it, five for an ox and four for a sheep. But notice verse 4. You jump down there to where he says, now, the intervening verses talk about a thief and if he's caught and hurt while he's stealing things. That's not particular to what I'm talking about today in terms of property rights or personal property. But verse 4 says, if the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether it's an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall restore double. So why the difference? If you sell it or kill it, you have to restore five for one or four for one, but if it's still with you, you only have to pay double. Why would that be? Anybody got an idea? What's that? Okay, you haven't profited from it yet. Maybe that's a part of it, that you haven't gained a personal profit from that. The animal's still with you. You haven't sold it. You haven't killed it and eaten it or something, so you haven't gained a profit. Others have speculated that perhaps this has to do with the possibility of repentance. As long as you have not disposed of that animal, there is a chance you could go back to the person, your conscience could go to work on you. It's a good animal. I like this animal. I'd love to keep this animal. Love the money I could get from selling it, but you know what? It's my neighbor's. Or I don't know whose it is, but it belongs to somebody. And I need to find whose animal this is. I need to get this animal back. And there's a possibility that you might still make restitution. Once you've sold it or once you've killed it, I mean, in your mind, it's a done deal. You're not backing off from that. You're not going back. You're not repenting. So the logic seems to be that there is a chance to still repent, or additionally, you haven't profited from it. You haven't gained really anything from it. If you're taking care of that animal, it may have even cost you a little bit. In fact, there's a passage in Leviticus 6 that indicates that if a thief voluntarily returns something that he has stolen, he pays, he gives it back, and the fine that he pays is basically a one-fifth, a 20% of the value of the animal on the open market, or the value of whatever the property is. So there's still a penalty for having put the owner through that turmoil of not knowing where their animal is, but it's not the same as if you kill or sell it. Now, there's a fourth type of property damage that's mentioned next in verses 5 and 6. If a man causes a fire or vineyard to be grazed and lets loose his animal and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the dregs of his field. No, it's interesting. God says, all right, you let your animal destroy somebody else's property, or you let a fire get out of hand and destroy somebody else's property, I want you to restore the same amount that was destroyed of your neighbor, but you give of the best of yours. Because what is human nature going to do? It's going to go find this scroungiest looking grain that you weren't going to save, you were going to grind or sell, and say, well, I'll give that in return. God says, no, take of the best. Give of the best to your neighbor. The best of his own vineyards. Verse 6, a fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed. He who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. So, again, this is a type of a property damage that is either premeditated or accidental theft by destruction of somebody else's property. Particularly here, it's described as a field of grain. And it's only fair in God's eyes that the one responsible pay to make good on the damage that he's caused, whether it's by his animal grazing or by fire, even if it wasn't intentional. So again, the principle here is God's way of life is a way of thoughtfulness. It's a way of thinking of your neighbor, loving your neighbor as yourself, thinking good of your neighbor, not calloused indifference. Now, the fifth type of property damage that is typically talked about in this section is involves items that are loaned to someone, whether it's animals or whether it's physical property, and whether it's loaned for safekeeping, whether it's loaned for perhaps to do some work, either as a loan or being hired. I won't read through all of these verses. There are quite a few here, 7 through 15. So I won't read all of them, but you can read down through them and note that God says you shall restore if something is stolen. First of all, you have to make sure you go before the judges and there's a decision made. Well, did this person steal it himself, or was it truly stolen from the one who was keeping this animal or whatever the product was? And the judges will decide. So there has to be discernment about that. In the end, it says down in verse 13, if the animal is torn by another beast, you bring that as evidence that I didn't kill the animal. This was a wild beast. Some wild animal killed it while I was trying to take care of it for my neighbor. And he says he shall not make good that which was torn. In other words, again, God says, look, I understand these things happen, that a wild animal could kill an animal while you were trying to take care of it. And verse 15, if its owner was with it, he shall not make it good. It was hired. If it was hired, it came for its hire. So if the owner is there, it's the owner's responsibility. But God is concerned about taking care of property that somebody loans you or that you borrow from someone else. Now, before we move on to that section about kidnapping or stealing a person. I'd like you to use your imagination a little bit. That's right, you have my permission to dream during the Bible study. Hopefully you're not asleep dreaming, but dream about the kingdom of God. Dream about the millennium. I'd like you to think for a little bit. Today, the Sabbath pictures the millennial rest. Think about what would be different in the millennium. Think about what products, think about what businesses will not exist in the world tomorrow because people will respect the property rights of others. I know you're thinking of 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 different things pop into your head right away. Let's quickly find somebody. Somebody give me one or two and we'll run down a list real quick. What? Collection agencies. People will pay what they owe, right? Security alarms. Car, house security alarm systems. Monitoring systems for those alarms. People employed to rush out and stop someone from stealing things. You got police forces. You got all kinds of things. Yes, Pat. Oh, police. You're going to say police, okay? Yes. Bail bondsmen. Okay. Locks and keys. I mean, all kinds of locks, keys. We have all kinds of keys. We have keys for our cars. We have keys for our house. We have keys for safe deposit boxes. Oh, safe deposit boxes. You won't need those, will you? Safes. You won't need safes. Won't need combination locks. Yes. Lojack. Yeah, you won't need Lojack. Or what's that thing, the club that you put on the steering wheel to keep people from stealing a car? You won't need the club. Won't need locksmiths either, will you? Another hand back there, Pat. Sorry? Oh, jails and prisons. Okay. Yes. Weapon manufacturing for safety, personal safety or protect your property. Yeah, won't need that. Maybe there still will be for hunting. I hope so. Oh, I don't know. Let's don't, no. Don't rain on my parade. No. There may not need to be hunting. I don't know what there'll be in the kingdom, but it does say they won't hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. But, I mean, you think about the industries that will no longer exist because people won't be stealing other people's property. I mean, it'll be a really incredibly wonderful, different world. Yes. Oh, anger management. Yeah. Well, that's maybe getting into another realm, but yeah, you want to need anger management seminars and people to handle all of those kinds of things. But anyway, yeah, identity theft. It's another thing. You won't need LifeLock, will you? Yeah, yeah, that's identity theft. There's a lot of that going on. One of the growing crimes in our modern world. In fact, December 2010, the Department of Justice, I jotted this down, estimated 11.7 million people suffered some kind of identity theft in the past 2 years. 11.7 million people. Cost was nearly $17.3 billion. Computer security? We won't need that. We won't need passwords. We won't be afraid of being hacked. That our personal information, our what do you call that? Personally identifiable information, PII, or personal credit, PCI, personal credit information. It's not going to be stolen. Nobody's going to try to steal your identity. People respect things. You won't have to shred canceled checks. You won't have to shred bank statements. You won't have to be worried about somebody stealing that type of thing. So we're talking about a really different world, aren't we? If people would simply respect the property laws, don't steal, don't take what isn't yours. Let's look quickly at what God says, his view of stealing a person. Exodus chapter 21, we're right here, don't have to go far in my Bible. I turn one page back. And it says in verse 16, he who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he's found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. Again, notice the incredible difference God places on material physical possessions versus a human being. In terms of personal goods, real property or personal property, God talks about restitution. He talks about repaying someone, even if it's accidental that you cause someone loss, you make it good. When it comes to human life, God says, that is very precious to me. And if somebody kidnaps a person, they get the death penalty. God has the right to impose that death penalty. Our nation, of course, recognizes that as a very terrible crime as well. Exodus 21:16. The FBI is the agency that gets involved in kidnapping. And there are a lot of kidnappings in the world, a lot of kidnappings in the United States. In fact, it might surprise you that as of February 2009, what city in the U.S. do you think is the kidnapping capital in the U.S.? El Paso? No, it's not El Paso. Not Tucson either. Phoenix. Who said that? Yeah, Scott. It's Phoenix, Arizona. Now, why Phoenix? I don't know. But it is the kidnapping capital. As of February 2010, it was the kidnapping capital of the United States. Guess where it fits in the rank in the world? Number two in the world. Only one other city in the world has more kidnappings than Phoenix, Arizona. Anybody want to venture a guess where that one is? What's that? Oh, Phoenix is related to drug cartels. That's why you have the kidnappings, okay? All right. Number one is where? Mexico City. You got it. Mexico City is number one in kidnappings. Phoenix, Arizona, in the United States, is number two in the world for kidnappings. Sad, sad statistic for our nation. And, of course, we can look at a verse or two here. Things thrown up there on the millennium. Let's take a look at kidnapping. We've already read Exodus. Let's go to Revelation chapter 18. Notice in the Babylon, the end time Babylon, there is a statement about trafficking in human beings. Revelation chapter 18, my Bible has a heading of the fall of Babylon. Verse 11 says, the merchants of the earth are going to weep and mourn over her. No one buys their merchandise anymore. And then it begins to list all the kinds of merchandise. If we look down at verse 13, cinnamon, incense, fragrant oil, frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots. And notice the very last phrase, and bodies and souls of men, trafficking in human beings, trafficking in human life, kidnapping and selling human beings. And we might think that odd, but in our day and time today, there's a lot of kidnapping and a lot of trafficking in human beings. It's very sad. The United Nations estimates that hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of women and children are kidnapped and trafficked every year. In fact, one source I saw said the UN estimate could be as high as 4 million per year. Now, of course, in our day, the sad thing is the most common type of modern slavery is for prostitution. And the sex trade, that's a horrible, horrible crime that our society is, our world is very much involved in. In the end time, Babylon's going to be involved in trading of human beings, human lives as well. Very sad statistic, very sad fact to read that God prophesies in the Bible. Now, what else can a person steal? We can steal intangibles too, can't we? Just as God places value on properties, on property, real property, personal property, I think God places value on other things as well. Reputation, time, which is money from an employer, that's stealing. Ask any of the employers here about, is there any problem with our society stealing time and money from an employer? The theft of items from work, that's so common in our society. Shoplifting, even the stealing from God, the stealing of tithes. That's the way God described it back in the book of Malachi. You're stealing from me when you steal tithes, he says. So there are lots of things that we could steal, lots of things that God says don't get involved in stealing. Let's conclude by looking at what God says in the New Testament about how this commandment impacts us as Christians. Let's go to 1 Corinthians to begin with, 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 and 10, there is a general statement here in terms of New Testament instruction. And verse 9 says, "Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, or adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners will inherit the kingdom of God." Thieves, he says, will not inherit the kingdom. And it's set right next to coveting, which often is one of the sparks for thievery, isn't it? That you want something that's not yours. It's tied into another one of the commandments of God, overlaps a bit with the eighth. But he says thieves simply won't go there. They won't be there. They won't inherit the kingdom. If we go to Ephesians chapter 4, we'll find again a verse you probably have memorized or are very familiar with, verse 28. Ephesians 4 and verse 28 shows again the mind of God, that God doesn't look to just do the bare minimum. God looks for us as Christians to go above and beyond in caring for our neighbor and treating our neighbor with respect and showing love and honor and respect to them. He expects us to go above the bare minimum. In verse 28, he says, "Let him who stole steal no longer." That would be the bare minimum. Just stop stealing. Do not thieve, do not steal is the Hebrew, do not thieve. Do not steal, the basic commandment says, but in terms of a New Testament Christian, he says, but rather let him, so go beyond just stopping the taking of things that aren't yours, but rather let him labor. Working with his own hands, what is good, that he may have something to give to him who has need. Go beyond just stopping your thievery. As it's been said before, if you just stop stealing, you could be a thief between jobs, you know. Everyone's not stealing when they're a thief between jobs. You're not, "Well, I'm not currently stealing. I'm not stealing anything right now." But your intent is to continue to do it. Then God says, it's not good enough just to stop. What I want you to do is take the extra effort to go the extra mile. So that comes back to what Abraham did, doesn't it? A wise move, I think, on Abraham's part with Abimelech. "Here are 7 ewe lambs. Take these with you, Abimelech." And their babies, and the babies of their babies, and their babies and babies and babies on down, generation after generation, will all be a witness of what we said today. This is my well. I dug it. Belongs to me. It's my property. But I want to dwell with you in peace. So rather than just having you admit it, let me give you a gift. Here. Go away. Don't just go away. Go away happy. Pretty smart, I think. Pretty wise. And it meets what God says for us as Christians in the New Testament, doesn't it? So God is not into communism. God clearly upholds the property rights of others and property ownership. And he's concerned that if someone takes property, that it needs to be restored. It needs to be made good. God expects restitution.